It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a conference in Wisconsin examines the concept of white privilege. We'll meet two of the presenters.
First, we're talking about the latest news on the Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Federal lawmakers from the area surrounding the Great Lakes wrote a letter to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers asking them to do more to stop the spread of Asian carp to the Great Lakes.
The letter was signed by a bipartisan group of 11 U.S. senators, including Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson. The senators wrote, quote, "We want to impress upon you the need to implement short-term measures to stop Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes and to move aggressively toward a long-term solution."
Dan Egan is with us now. He's a Great Lakes reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
I want to start with some of the basics. With the Asian carp, what happens when the Asian carp invades an ecosystem?
It depends on the ecosystem, but what's happened in the Mississippi River Basin over the last 20 years is that they've literally overrun stretches of river and squeezed aside, if not entirely eliminated, native species. And these fish are not like other fish in the ecosystem. They're incredibly reproductive. They grow fast. They grow big. And they jump out of the water, which can be a problem for boaters on infested stretches of water.
So when it comes to Asian carp, is the nightmare scenario that they enter an ecosystem and they pretty much take over and come close to wiping out some of the natural species?
Well, I think that that's been the case in some stretches of river in the Mississippi Basin. I think the jury is still out as far as what will happen or would happen if they get into the Great Lakes. I think the consensus is that the open waters of the lakes aren't nearly as productive, filled with food as some of these Mississippi River Basin stretches of river. So nobody's envisioning carp popping like popcorn out in the middle of the lakes. But they do expect that they could do fairly well in the warmer bays and harbors and river systems that feed the lakes, which also happen to be where all the people are. So that's something to think about.
What do Asian carp look like?
Well, they don't look like a normal fish. The big head carp look like they're swimming upside down. They look like their eyes are below their mouths, and their mouths are big enough to gobble softballs. But from the head on down, they look pretty much just like a fish.
Do you have a sense of how close the Asian carp are to invading the Great Lakes right now?
Well, that's the question that everybody wants answered. They've got an electric barrier on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal that is supposed to be keeping the fish back, but it's not operating at a level strong enough to repel all sizes of fish. Little fish need a bigger jolt because they don't have as much surface area. That said, they've only found one actual Asian carp above this electric barrier, and that was in Calumet Harbor, which is directly connected to Lake Michigan, just south of downtown Chicago. Beyond that, they've found DNA evidence of the fish all over Chicago above the barrier. And when I say above the barrier, I mean on the lake side of the barrier. Water samples have routinely picked up the fish since 2009, I believe. Evidence of the fish, not the fish themselves.
The Army Corps of Engineers released a plan earlier this year to stop the spread of Asian carp. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in the plan and the budget involved?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much a plan as it is a menu of options ranging from doing nothing to rebuilding the Continental Divide in the middle of Chicago, the subcontinental divide, the divide that divides Lake Michigan from the Mississippi River Basin. And if they were to do that, it would cost a lot of money, and it would take a fair amount of time, but probably not as much time or money as the Army Corps has anticipated in its study.
When you mentioned rebuilding the barrier between the Mississippi and the Great Lakes Water Basin, as I understand it, that is a plan that could take a really long time. We're talking more than a decade, right?
Yeah. The problem isn't building some kind of a structure and dropping it in the canal. It's doing it in a manner that won't cause horrible flooding throughout Chicago or big environmental trouble for Lake Michigan. Because Chicago's sewage treatment plant discharges are still, they don't disinfect. So they're still pretty filthy, and you don't want them going into Lake Michigan. You want them going away from the lake, if you care about the lake. But then again, if you care about the Mississippi River Basin, you're not really too thrilled about what Chicago sends downriver. But yeah, the project is a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar project, any way you look at it.
Now, that would be the whole enchilada, the biggest part of the plan, but there were some short-term solutions being proposed as well. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the quicker fixes?
Well, yeah, and quick is a relative term, but I think the one that's getting the most attention right now is to turn one of the navigation locks on the canal system. I think it actually may be below the canal and on the river itself, but you would turn it into a sterilization chamber, essentially. By that, I mean the water that goes into it would be poisoned, or they'd pump carbon dioxide into it, do something that would make it unfriendly to fish, that would kill them. That's their plan, but they haven't designed anything like this yet either, so it's not going to be happening in the next year or so.
Has it ever been tried before?
Using a lock like this, mm-hmm. No, I don't think it has. I think that there's some promising research that shows carbon dioxide actually can do the job, but I don't think the Army Corps has explored this too far at this point. I think they may be getting some pressure from some people to do this, but no, they've never used locks like this, as far as I know. It's a novel idea, and something's got to be done, because what they have now is not going to work for the long haul.
Now, a group of federal lawmakers whose states have stakes or are stakeholders in the Great Lakes areas, including Wisconsin Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson, they wrote a letter to the Army Corps of Engineers asking them to do more to stop the spread of Asian carp. Do you have any idea what they're asking for, what they'd like to be done?
Well, it was, from what I could determine from that letter, they want something fast. And by that, I think they want something done with one of these navigation locks. That's their short-term solution. And then they want the Corps to proceed ahead, looking at what it'll take for a long-term solution. And most people agree that the only long-term solution is physical separation of the two watersheds. They were naturally separated until Chicago built its canal, linking Lake Michigan to the Mississippi Basin. And they did that to flush its sewage away from its drinking water intakes on Lake Michigan and down into the Gulf of Mexico, ultimately.
And states not included in that letter were Illinois and Indiana, and they would be directly affected by the solutions proposed. And you talked about changes to the way that Illinois processes sewage, and a lot of the money for some of these big plans would go toward that. Do you know where they stand on this? They didn't sign the letter.
No, I don't know why they didn't sign it. I do know that the Illinois governor expressed his support for this concept last summer. It's more controversial in Illinois and Indiana because it would have an impact on the barge industry that relies on the canals, the extent of which is very debatable. Some people say it's just not as much traffic as you would expect it to be, and therefore it's not going to be as big of an economic impact. Also, Illinois and Indiana stand to gain from this as well. I mean, if there's a lot of federal dollars going into these wastewater treatment and stormwater management projects that are affiliated with stopping the carp, that's a good thing for the citizens of those two states.
So why do you think, just to speculate for a moment, why do you think they stood back from this?
I have no idea. I can't get inside their heads. I mean, these things happen quickly. They circulate the letters, they get the people to sign, and then it's off. So I don't know.
We talked about sort of the big plan, the building of the divide, and how that could take more than a decade, tons of money, billions of dollars, and some of the shorter-term fixes, which would still require billions of dollars, but would be using this a tweak to an existing lock. Do you think that these actions will come soon enough? In either case, you talked about the DNA being found already in the Great Lakes. Is the action moving quickly enough?
I don't know. But I do know that this isn't just about Asian carp, and it never really has been. It's about these two watersheds that are artificially connected and the biological mischief that can make its way between the two via the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. They initially identified dozens of species poised to ride out of the lakes and into the Mississippi, or from the Mississippi into the lakes, that can have a real negative impact economically and ecologically. For example, there's the VHS virus in the Great Lakes that, if it were to get loose down in the southern fish farm industry, it could wreak economic havoc. Those fish farms actually are the same. That's the same place where the Asian carp originally came from. So this is a two-way highway, and it's not just species or carp species that are riding it.
How big of a difference do you think the letter from these senators will make in the struggle to prevent Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes?
Well, I don't know what one letter can do, but it's definitely, the debate has changed from 10 years ago when it was just a kind of crazy talk to look at separating the basins. It's gone much more mainstream, and every time a new species is at the door, this problem isn't going to go away. The electric barrier on the canal was originally built to stop a different species of fish around goby from going out of the Great Lakes into the Mississippi Basin. Well, they didn't get it built in time. The goby made it into the Mississippi, and the barrier was repurposed as a carp barrier. So that's what we have today, and who knows what it might be a barrier for in 5 years.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
That was Dan Egan, Great Lakes reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk with the news today that Wisconsin senators joined others to call for action to stop the spread of Asian carp. There's been a lot of talk over the years about the experience of people from different racial and ethnic groups in the United States. We don't always talk about what it means to be white.
A conference starting in Madison this week explores this theme, examining the relationship between race and privilege.
The White Privilege Conference is in its 15th year. It's the first year this national conference is being held in Madison.
The term white privilege can raise eyebrows. What is white privilege, and why have a conference about it, are some questions. We've asked two conference participants to help us better understand. Amer Ahmed is Associate Director of Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs at the University of Ann Arbor, and Abby Ferber is a Professor of Sociology and Women's and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Amer, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Abby, it's good to have you along as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Abby, I want to start with you. What is white privilege?
I think it's really the flip side of racial oppression. Just as you mentioned earlier, we don't often think about how race impacts white people. We often assume it shapes the lives of people of color who are the victims of racism and inequality. But white privilege allows us to understand the ways in which our system of racism and white supremacy in the U.S. confers systematic privileges on people who are seen to be white.
Amer, let's go to you next. I think it would be helpful to examine some specific instances of this. You've got some of these up on the conference website, but could you walk us through some examples of what we mean when we say white privilege?
Yeah, well, with privilege, it's an unearned privilege that oftentimes when you're the recipient of the privilege, it's something that you don't necessarily have to think about. Whereas when you're subject to the marginality around race or another identity, it's something that you're forced to have to confront all the time. So there's many aspects in which, as a person of color, you know, you end up asking yourself, am I experiencing these things because of the way I look? Because do I feel the pressure that I have to represent many, many people all the time whenever I do anything? You get asked that question all the time. And also just all these kind of implicit ways in which there's kind of this expectation of a norm in which we have to meet and expect, which is really more aligned with the experience of being white than being a person of color. So kind of even when we say the word American, a lot of times when we characterize what we're talking about when we meet when we say American, we're actually meaning references to white people as opposed to those of us who might fall outside of those norms.
And some examples on the website, just to play off the last thing you said, being able to assume that most of the people you or your children study in history classes and textbooks will be of the same race, gender, or sexual orientation as you are. Another is to assume that your failures will not be attributed to your race or your gender. Another, assume that if you work hard and follow the rules, you'll get what you deserve. And these are, in some senses, subtle things that if you are a white American and you go through life, you might never think twice about these. Why is it important to bring them to the surface and talk about them, Abby?
Well, I think it's important because it's important for white people to see that race impacts our lives as well. You know, I never thought about race as something that impacted me until I was in college and started to learn about our system of white supremacy and white privilege. Before then, I always saw it as someone else's problem. I didn't think that I had any control or even felt empowered to make a difference in terms of confronting racism. But once I began to see the ways in which I benefited from white privilege, it really did free me up to see that this is something I need to be a part of. I need to be a part of changing this system of racism because I benefited from it, even in ways that I don't see every day.
Now, this conference has been going on. I think this is the 15th year, and it has drawn some resistance both now and in previous years, sometimes even outrage. In a recent blog, Dave Blaska, a former Dane County board member, wrote that the conference sends the message that, quote, white people are the problem. And in that sense, what I get when I hear that comment from Dave Blaska is that he feels a little under attack. Amir, what would you say to that?
Well, what I would say is that would we argue that male privilege is not real and that there's not a historical legacy of systems that have benefited males based on institutionalized sexism? I don't think we would make that argument, but I think that because race is unique in its history in the United States and is oftentimes a third rail in terms of what people are willing to engage and talk about, and it's very personal. A lot of people don't want to confront and deal with these things, and so it's oftentimes met with a resistance and marginalized as something that should not be engaged and talked about, as if it is uniquely exceptional and different than if we talked about these other issues, you know. And I think when myself as a male, I don't have to apologize for being a man. I was born a man. You know, white people don't have to apologize for being white, but at the same time, there is this benefit. We have to think about how does the world that we live in, how is it impacted by this history that has not been fully reconciled and dealt with? And if we look at examples like in South Africa where they had reconciliation process, we've never fully had those conversations here. And how do we engage the way these things are playing out, both for white people as well as all the different ways in which people of color then therefore end up constantly having to accommodate and work around this white privilege and racism as we experience in the United States?
And Abby, would you agree with that, that is the reason that this tends to draw a strong, well, not tends to, but it does among some people draw a strong reaction and maybe some feelings that that there is judgment there? What do you think is going on?
Well, I think that people feel that way when they have not yet begun to explore the issue of white privilege. We don't hear that response from people that have attended the conference. And that's why the conference attendance grows year after year, because once people go, you know, and primarily white people are the majority of the people attending the conference, they come back every year because white people are part of the problem, but it also means we can be part of the solution. And so in many ways, it's a very positive conference because we're coming together to look at ways in which together we can work to dismantle racism. And I would challenge people who criticize the conference to come and experience it first and to read about white privilege and understand what that means. It's not about blaming white people, but it's about saying this is about all of us. We all need to work together to understand the ways in which race is institutionalized in our society. It's not about, as a white person, it's not about anything I did or didn't do. You know, I can't ask the cops to follow me on the road for driving while white. I have no choice in the matter. I have white privilege whether I want it or not. But I can use that then to become a part of the solution.
And let's start there, Abby, in the interest of understanding. When did you, as a white person, first realize that you thought you were privileged as a result of the color of your skin?
Really, when I was a college student, mostly around the time I was in graduate school, at first I had been really interested in issues of gender. And I think, like most people, we tend to see our oppressed identities first. So I was very aware of the ways in which I had been limited or stereotyped as a woman. And yet, once I was became introduced to the concept of privilege, really by Peggy McIntosh's article, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, she draws an analogy to the gender issue that was just raised with the race issue. And just as men experience male privilege, whether they want it or not, I began to see the ways in which I had benefited from white privilege my whole life, and yet it was all invisible to me. And I'm still really learning every day, seeing more and more of the ways in which I benefit from my white privilege. it's really a lifelong process, I think, of examining this.
As we go now into the news, here's a hip-hop song by Amer Ahmed talking about our cultural interconnectedness. We're talking with Amer Ahmed, Associate Director of Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and Abby Ferber, Professor of Sociology and Women's and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Both are participants in this year's White Privilege Conference, which starts Wednesday in Madison.
It's 4:36, and you're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the White Privilege Conference now, which starts in Madison this week, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you think studying the concept of white privilege is helpful, and do you see it at work in your daily life, or do you not buy it? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us on talk@wpr.org.
We're talking with conference participants Amer Ahmed of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and Abby Ferber with the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs.
And we'll go to our phone lines now. We've got Laura joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Laura.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I first learned or really internalized the idea of white privilege around 1968. And since that time, I've been a high school teacher. I've tried to tell it to my classes, and I've tried to tell it to other teachers, and I found nothing but resistance. And I could tell you many stories, but what's the point? I think, you know, the people listening to this probably understand. When people say such things as slavery was a long time ago, what's wrong now? You know, we should all be equal. Or they say such things where they obviously do not have one iota, one conception of what it's like to be a minority because they've never been such. It's very difficult to teach such a concept, and some people just don't have the consciousness. They're not bad people. They just have to go through a little suffering before they really see what it's like.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Laura. And Laura talking about some of the resistance that she encountered and that this can be something that's difficult to talk about. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but Amer, what advice would you give someone like Laura if they did want to try to broach it, open a conversation, and met resistance?
Yeah, I mean, you know, earlier I mentioned the example of male privilege and how myself as a self-identified male, you know, benefit. And I think a huge part of the work is around self-awareness and empathy. First of all, coming into an understanding of your own identity and who you are and how that may be similar or different from somebody else's experience. And then that empathy, and part of where the empathy gap is for a lot of people is that we dismiss when we hear other people's experiences when they say, I experienced this. So if a woman said to me, well, I experienced sexism because such and such and such, if I, as a male, said to that person, well, I'm sure that they didn't mean anything by it, or, you know, I'm sure it's really not that, that woman would not feel very empathized by me. They would feel very dismissed by me, right? That I haven't really heard what they're saying about their experience. So part of it is coming into an understanding of yourself and then truly empathizing with somebody's experience and realizing, regardless of what I think, it's real for them. It's true for them. So how do we come into really listening and hearing and being willing to take that risk in order for us to all come to a place in which we have a better understanding of how we experience the world around some of these issues?
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Laura. And let's go next to Will in Madison. Hi, Will.
Hello. I'm calling from Madison, where, of course, the White Privilege Conference will be. And I've got a question for Abby. And I'm grateful that it's here and that it's happening and that indeed it's expanding. I'd like to hear more about how Madison was chosen, if you know the story behind it. And I know of all the disparities and the issues that are happening here in southern Wisconsin around this topic of white privilege, but I'm just curious how this came about.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the thoughts, Will. And Abby, do you know some of the backdrop of Madison right now and how you chose Madison as the spot this year?
Yes, certainly. Actually, we didn't choose Madison. Madison chose us. So we moved to a different city every year. And it's basically local organizations and communities coming together and working with us, the leadership of the conference, and saying, we want to bring this conference to our community. And that planning often happens a number of years in advance. And we work, the national team works with a large local team on the ground because the conference is almost entirely run by volunteers. And we work over a period of numerous years to find a location, find sponsors, get people together, promote the conference, and make it happen. And so we're coming to Madison because a large number of people in that community and organizations like the YWCA came and said, we need to have this conference here, and they were willing to do the work and have done it successfully.
All right. Well, thank you, Will, for that question. And in Wisconsin here, we have been struggling with pretty stark racial disparities, especially in the field of education. That's one. For instance, a much higher rate of poverty among black students than white. I think the rate for white poverty is 5%, and there are other statistics in that vein. Do you think that makes Wisconsin a particularly good place to hold the conference, Amer?
I think it is. We've been learning about some of the childhood poverty rates in particular in Dane County, if I'm correct, right? That's Milwaukee County, it's disturbing to hear the numbers. But certainly it's not the only place in which we see that. I mean, I live in Southeast Michigan, and we certainly see these challenges here as well. So I think, you know, certainly it's a great place to hold it, especially based on the demographics of the state and the way the distribution is in the state, but also as a place in the middle of the United States, in a country that is basically struggling with these issues in general, and so I think that it's great that it's in Wisconsin, but hopefully we have the participation from around the country, and that we can have conversations about how these disparities and how these issues play out in various contexts around the country.
Okay, and let's go to another caller. We've got Ronaldo on the line from Eau Claire. Hi there, Ronaldo.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a Hispanic male, and I've never seen white privilege, or I've never heard Hispanic people even talk about white privilege. So I don't know where this is going. It's 2014. I think the line has to be drawn on this white guilt. What I mean by that is I understand that these two guests have a cause that they believe in, but what exactly are they out to solve?
All right. Well, thank you, Ronaldo, for your thoughts and his perspective there. And this I've seen echoed elsewhere, that white privilege can be an excuse for white liberals to get together and sort of self-flagellate to feel bad about things. And is there anything to that? What do you think about that critique? Abby, let's start with you.
Sure. I think there's very little to that critique. For me, understanding white privilege is not at all about white guilt. There's nothing to feel guilty about because I didn't create the system, but I do benefit from it. And so I need to be accountable. It means I need to be a part of change. And for people who attend the White Privilege Conference, they know that it's not about sitting around and feeling bad as white people. It's about taking action. It's about building bridges across communities, across race, among different generations, to talk about how we can work together to address some of the very real problems that you were just recently referring to that currently exist in Dane County and in so many counties across the country.
Amer, we're going to wrap up with you. If people want to take action, like Abby said, this isn't about feeling bad. It's about taking action and building bridges. What are some things that they can do personally in their own lives and in their communities?
Yeah, well, when one has privilege, and again, I've used the example of male privilege many times here today, is that, you have an access to social power that somebody else might not have. So how do you leverage that? So around my areas of privilege, what are the things that I can do to empower those who are oftentimes marginalized and ensure that those voices are heard and supported, while also really doing the personal work that I need to do to really examine what are the things that I need to learn about? What are the things that I need to challenge in myself? And that's hard work, And in terms of for the caller kind of talking about what is the point, for me, I think we have to come to a better understanding of each other. This is a very diverse country, and myself as a South Asian Muslim who grew up in Ohio, my nieces and nephews are experiencing similar things that I experienced, and so this will just generationally be passed on if we don't find ways to interrupt it, find ways to have these conversations, and come to a better understanding of who we are in relationship to one another.
Amir, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Abby, good to have you along, too.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Amir Ahmed, Associate Director of Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and Abby Ferber, Professor of Sociology and Women's and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Both will be at this year's White Privilege Conference. For more information about the conference, you can follow the link from the Central Time Facebook page.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. This winter gave us these spectacular ice caves in the Apostle Islands, but ice can do more than just look beautiful. Musician Marlon Leadon rode his bike around the icy surface of Lake Superior, recording the sounds of the ice.
I grew up in Washburn, just a few blocks away from Schwamigan Bay on Lake Superior. As long as I can remember, that was where we always went as a family. And then once I was able to ride a bike, that's where every single bike trip, led me, was to the lake. I really wanted to see more of the Apostle Islands, and at that point I hadn't had any sort of boat, but at the time I was living in the Twin Cities, and I was pretty involved with the bicycle scene down there, and the whole fat bike, the snow bike thing was just beginning, and that just kind of called to me, was to get one of those bikes and just bike on the ice. The recording part came into play when a student from the Bayfield School came out with an article in the paper about there's starting to be less and less ice cover on Lake Superior every year. And this is based off of the records from the ferry line. And I've always been into music and audio and recording, and it was like, well, maybe I should record these ice sounds, because if ice is on the decline, there's lots of sounds that are just gonna disappear. We'll never hear them again. The lake drums, which is this incredibly loud, booming drum sound. That comes from the ice when it contracts and expands. Sometimes I'll be out there and there'll just be one loud crack and boom. And a lot of the sound comes from below the ice. But then there's other times, when we're having cold nights and warm days, and the temperature change is pretty extreme, that as the sun is coming up or going down, it's like it's just constantly going on, this booming and cracking. It's like a fireworks show, but there's no fireworks. I saw quite a few ice fishermen out in the islands, but I only talked to maybe three people the whole time, and I just mentioned to them what I was doing, what I was kind of like, sort of like ice fishing for sounds, and they thought I was crazy. Everything's always moving when you're out there. It's like nonstop, and so even when you don't hear anything, if you put headphones on and drop the microphone, the hydrophone through the ice, there's gonna be sounds galore. And so there was this crackling sound, and then there was these bubbling sounds which came from these ice caves that were right on the edges of some of the islands. Most people were just shocked at like how loud this sound really was, and how it sounds a lot like a drum, so it's really easy to relate to the sound because it's almost familiar.
This episode is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or search Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Well, between the sights and sounds, it's been a busy winter for Lake Superior, and who better to talk about what's happening up on Lake Superior than WPR's own Mike Simonson. He's been up there looking at the ice, talking about the ice caves, a lot happening in the very tippy top of the state. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's been, icy roads, icy lake, icy caves, icy everything.
So ice breaking, they're opening up the lakes to shipping, or at least the official open date is upon us. How realistic is it to get ships out there on Lake Superior?
Well, the Sioux locks are going to open a few days later than scheduled because this ice is as thick as it's been, well, one of the old-timers told me, in a quarter of a century or longer. In fact, wow. I think he said it's the thickest he's ever seen, and he's been in the business for almost half a century. He's a 70-year-old who runs a couple of the tugs in the Duluth Superior Harbor, and he said that just to get his tug free from the ice so he could start breaking ice, they had to use chainsaws and axes on the ice.
Wow. Do we have any word yet whether this is, in fact, a record year for the ice depth?
The Coast Guard says it's the heaviest in a quarter of a century. And one of the traffic guys who schedules the icebreaker, he's been doing it for almost 25 years. He says this is the thickest he's ever seen. But in the harbors, it's the thickest as anywhere because, you know, it's a smaller area. So Duluth Superior is finding 4 to 5 feet thick ice. Lake Superior, though, has spots where it's also 3 to 4 feet deep. And so, I mean, we're talking about having ice out there in June.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something. Well, we were hearing through the winter about the big economic boon that the ice caves are bringing to some places. I imagine this is a big economic worry for a lot of business up there if the ice doesn't let them get shipping as soon as they're ready to.
Yeah, it's the ships have already started leaving the Duluth Superior port. I think 3 left over the weekend. They're going to Two Harbors to get ore, and then there are going to be 3 Coast Guard ice cutters escorting them down to the Sioux locks. So the ore is going to move. It's going to start slowly, but usually these things, they can catch up on on the loads and make up for lost time if it doesn't, you know, go on too much longer. But, you know, last weekend it was below zero up here at night.
And what about the tourist trade? If there is ice on the lakes until June and chilly temperatures, is that going to slow down the tourist season? Well, it was a booming winter season. Is that going to impact, do you think, the spring end of things?
Well, that's interesting because even though there was a plethora of snow and ski hills opened early because this all hit around Thanksgiving and stuck with us because it was, you know, so cold, but because it was so cold, snowmobilers and skiers couldn't get out there on so many days. You know, when you've got a 30, 40 below zero wind chill, you know, it's not a whole lot of fun to be outside at all. So it turned out not to be a bad year, but it turned out to be an average year, even though it was an above average snow winter. So, you know, as far as the Memorial Day is when the tourism season starts, but it really kicks off July 4th. So I think the concern would be for the fishing opener in May. And last year, you might remember, there was a snowstorm, I think, the day before, and they had to use ice augers to, you know, get through the lake and to drop a line.
So May is not supposed to be ice fishing season, even on Lake Superior.
Right. So, you know, that definitely could be a factor with fishing and with tourism from that standpoint.
Anything that we should know about how the wildlife, you think, will react to the late spring? I'm just wondering if the bears are going to come out of hibernation and be, you know, extra hungry because of this winter, and whether there are any problems that you're foreseeing.
I don't think bears can get any hungrier than they are when they get out of their hibernation. But I did see up here our first Canadian geese over the weekend. That was really nice, but I don't know where they're going to go because everything is frozen over. So maybe they found a few ponds where there's an outtake of water or something. But yeah, the birds, everything's going to be late this year.
You mentioned that there were icebreakers going with those 3 ships that have already left. How many icebreakers get out in the Duluth Superior area when they're really going full bore there?
Well, I think we're talking about 3 regular ice cutters. We're talking about a couple of private ice cutters. I don't know what Thunder Bay in Canada has. I'm sure the Canadian cutters will be out there as well. I'm trying to remember all the names of them. They're rather exotic, like Katmai Bay or something like that. They're going to be as busy as they've been when they were ending the season, because you remember that the season goes till January 15th and then ships have to dock. So they were working steady since early December when the first storms and cold hit. And usually they don't have to work that steady. So they work, you know, really hard right up until late January, and then they started in early March. So and it's if you've, I'm sure you've ridden on an icebreaker or two, but it's a really a jarring experience.
I have not. What does it feel like to be out there breaking through the ice?
I've been out once, not this year. Our student intern, I sent him out there, and he called from on board the Alder, the Cutter Alder, and he said, this is an unbelievable experience. It is loud, and it is crunching, and the hulls go up on the ice, settle on it, and then it crushes the ice, and it moves another few feet. And he said a few times they got stuck, and they had to drop something with, like 1,800-ton bricks on the side of the boat to free the boat on either side so it could back up and get going again. It was quite an effort.
So how does the icebreaker actually work? You said it kind of heaves up onto the ice and then it crushes it beneath. Are there moving gears beneath, kind of grinding it? Or
no, but the hulls are reinforced. I couldn't tell you how thick, but, you know, they're made to do this kind of thing. And, in fact, the ore carriers themselves, the ore boats, also have reinforced tugs or hulls. So they can in themselves break ice, but usually what happens is the hulls of the ore boats just plain stop, and then the cutters have to come in and cut the ice in front of them and just kind of do a circle around the boat. Mm-hmm. When I was out there that one time, they did have to rescue a 1,000-footer, and that was something to watch.
Does all this ice, this unusual amount of ice, make things more dangerous for the ore freighters or for the icebreakers themselves, for that matter?
No, I think everybody's playing it smart. They know they're not going to make good time, and they're this is the first time I've heard that they're having three Coast Guard cutters escorting vessels across the lake, you know, from the west side to the east side. And I'm not even sure how long it's going to take, but it's got to take 3-4 times as long as it usually does. But I think everybody's playing it smart, and they realize this is just a very unusual ice pack.
Mike, last question. What are the locals saying about this winter? What kinds of things did you hear people saying?
Can't say that on the air. We'll lose our I mean, to a T, everybody's complaining about it. You know, I had last week off, and people said, how was your vacation? I says, I got a tan, I lost weight, and we had a half foot of snow. So,
wow. All right. Well, thank you for giving us the view from up in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, it was fun.
We've been talking to Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter based in Superior.